Thompson, we're good to go.
Yes. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. David Thompson for the plaintiff appellants. Government of the people is an empty promise if an agency can be simultaneously unaccountable to the President, the Congress, and the judiciary. The FHFA stands alone in our nation's history as such an agency. It is unaccountable to the President. We are told it is unaccountable to the judiciary, and it is not subject to the normal appropriations process, and thus Congress and the President cannot exercise oversight in that respect. To make matters worse, the FHFA is led by a single director, and as the Supreme Court in Free Enterprise noted, perhaps the most telling indication of the severe constitutional problem here is the lack of historical precedent. It is true that in Humphrey's executor, the court blessed the FTC, which was headed by a nonpartisan body of experts that could not be changed all at once. But the FHFA is a unitary, inexpert, partisan agency that reports to no one. The only other agency in our nation's history that comes close to this is the CFPB.
But if we were to find that part unconstitutional and strike it such that the President would have the power to fire without having to show good cause, how does that help you?
Well, the court would also need to, and it would be appropriate, to vacate the order. That's what happened in Noel Canning. In Noel Canning, the Supreme Court looked at the structure of the NLRB. The D.C. Circuit had vacated the relevant order there, and the Supreme Court affirmed that. And that, under the APA, is the normal process.
But does the President want to fire this person? I mean, I'm just not understanding how the greater power to the President is going to help you in this case.
Well, Your Honor, that is an argument that they have made. They've said, well, how do you know things would be any different if this feature were fixed and the removal provision was taken out? And under footnote 12 of Free Enterprise, that is a burden we do not bear. The Supreme Court was very clear in Free Enterprise to say that plaintiffs do not need to establish a counterfactual world in which there is no separation of powers problem and hypothesize what would happen in that world. And the Supreme Court was really piggybacking and expanding on a point that Justice Scalia made in Lujan. In footnote 7 of Lujan, Justice Scalia said procedural rights are special, and they're special because the plaintiff doesn't need to show.
But this isn't your procedural right, this is the President's right, and I guess what I'm saying is I understand if somebody without authority makes a ruling and then that person's removed, that you have to have a do-over. I get that if one of us were not properly a judge or something like that. I'm having more trouble here with if you fix the statute. I'm not asking I'm not asking you to do counterfactual. I'm just saying what difference does that make?
In
it doesn't look like this person was sought to be removed.
Well, it would, again, we don't think we need to make that showing, but it could well make a difference because at the time of the network sweep, the Obama administration was able to say, well, this was an independent agency and we had to negotiate with the agency. And so the political landscape would look very different, potentially, in the political
landscape. So try to describe with a little more granular detail exactly what does our order look like? What are the mechanics of redressability as you see them? Because you mentioned
yes.
Noel Canning, but they went back and they vacated everything.
Yes.
Since the improper configuration of the board. It wasn't just vacating one item or one decision or one action. They went back and swept away a whole bunch. You're seeking only the vacating of the sweep and not everything else, but why not everything else?
Well, Your Honor, we don't oppose vacating everything else, the agency in toto. And as Your Honor points out, that happens with some frequency. The NLRB in Noel Canning had to go back and re-ratify some of its decisions. The FEC in the aftermath of the D.C. Circuit's decision in FEC versus NRA had to go back and ratify. Director Cordray, head of the CFPB, was appointed pursuant to an improper recess appointment.
So describe again in detail what an order from this court would say.
Yeah, well, first let me just say this court would have broad discretion to use its equitable powers, but I think the court would have one of two different approaches that it could do. One, it would vacate the actual order of the network sweep, declaring it invalid because we have Article III standing. We've been injured by that. That injury was caused by the defendant agency, and vacating it would redress our injury. In addition, this court would go on to say that the for-cause removal provision that confers independence upon the director, Director Watt, that should be invalidated. But as Judge Henderson's ruling in PHH, or not her ruling, but her opinion in PHH points, there's another approach this court could take, which is to say that the entire structure of this agency, which is unaccountable to all three branches, is itself unconstitutional, and that would be what the order would look like.
So when you talk about invalidating the sweep, what does that look like? Is it, couple of $100 billion a big brick truck is rolled up to FHFA. How does it work?
Yes, Your Honor. That's a great question. So there are a couple approaches. Our preferred approach is that the liquidation preference that the government holds now would be deemed to have been paid down by the excess payments that have been made. And when you calculate in the interest, it turns out that that would make the liquidation preference about zero. So it would just be an accounting entry. There would be no needs for the Brinks trucks. Another approach, of course, would be to require the Treasury to pay back the $124 billion that was taken off the balance sheets of these institutions. But our preferred approach is to just make an accounting adjustment of the pay down of the liquidation preference. In terms of other reasons this single director feature is unconstitutional, there's a real threat to liberty when you have a single director. As Judge Kavanaugh eloquently put, when you have a multi-member body, it can only go as far as the middle vote. And when you have one person, there's no need for compromise, there's no need for deliberation, there's no need for, there's no ability for dissent. And so having that multi-member panel was very important for Humphrey's executor, and that's what we see. Now, they point to three agencies. They point to the OCC, but the OCC, the head of the OCC can be fired at any time by the president, provided he gives a reason. That's not much of an impingement on the president's authority.
Does it matter here that the president himself gets to determine what constitutes cause for removal of the FHFA director?
There are many statutes, Your Honor, where it's silent as to what cause means. This is one of them, and that is a distinction, again, from the CFPB. But it's always been understood to be a very high and severe restriction on the president, and it was treated as such in Humphrey's executor, Your Honor. They also point to the Social Security Administration, but that was a multi-member panel until 1994. And of course, it has quasi-adjudicatory powers, and it is subject to normal appropriations, normal judicial review, and it does not have independent litigating authority. They also point, the other example that they have is of the Office of Special Counsel, which is from 1978. It's a personnel agency subject to normal appropriations, normal judicial review, and it does not have independent litigating authority. I think these two, they really don't get credit for the OCC, but these two examples they have would fall within what the Supreme Court in Noel Canning called scattered historical examples. They are nothing more than that, and it is a telling sign that there are so few examples. They In addition to the liberty and the history interest, it's important to look at the way in which the president's power is diminished. The president's power is diminished here because he has no voice in this agency. There are no staggered terms. There is no bipartisanship. It could even last all 5 years in which the president has no ability to make an appointment here. And even with respect to the acting director, if the acting director is removed for cause, the president is required to pick one of the three deputies that the prior director himself put in. So if President Obama had found for cause reasons for removing acting director DeMarco, he would have had to pick one of the three Republican appointees to be in charge of the agency. That's a severe diminution in presidential power. In addition, the president, because this agency doesn't get money appropriated, the president can't use the appropriations process and the threat of a veto of shutting the agency down to hold it to account in any way. And of course, the judicial review provision, at least as interpreted by the district court, is quite sweeping. I'd like to turn to the statutory arguments as well under the APA. And there are a couple of linchpins of the analysis that the district court and the other courts that have addressed this issue have looked to. First of all, they say that the language that says that the conservator may operate it in a sound and solvent way, they say, well, they put a lot of emphasis on the word may. And the FHFA has consistently, and we collect these quotes on page 31 and 32 of our brief, over and over again, the FHFA has said, this is a mandate. And the reason they've said it is a mandate is because all agencies are created with only the powers that are given to them by Congress. Congress gave the FHFA the power to operate it in a sound and solvent manner. It nowhere in HERA was the authority given to operate it in an unsound manner. And so they simply don't have the power that they are claiming here, and that's why they've said over and over again it's a mandate. And this court in McAllister said that a conservator, quote, only has the power to take actions necessary to restore a troubled financial institution to solvency. That's significant. You know, I would note that if they are right, and that in fact the use of the word may gives them carte blanche to do whatever they want, then there's a serious non-delegation problem here. And obviously the court should construe the statute to avoid that, not to create that sort of problem. In addition, they also put a lot of weight on B2J. And there are several different prisms through which the court could look at B2J. It could look at the text of the statute, or canons of construction, or precedent, or historical practice, or it could look at the legislative history. And if any of those five prisms are used, we win. And I'll explain why. With respect to the language of the statute, B2J says that these are powers, quote, authorized by this section. Authorized by this section. That means that it's not a freestanding grant, some superpower that they can do whatever they want. They have to point to another provision of this statute to get the authority that they seek. It also says that they're doing so as conservator, and of course that harkens back to B2D. As Judge Brown in her dissent said, B2D sets the parameters of the powers of the conservator. And it also says it's an incidental power. So that's the text. If we look at canons of construction, their interpretation says, well, we can do what's in our best interest. That would create massive takings liability for the United States government. If an agency can just come in and take what it wants, that would be a significant takings issue, number one. A second canon is they're trying to exalt this general description of operating in the best interest of the entity or the agency and use that to trump specific guidance of preserve and conserve, operate in a sound and solvent manner. And there also would render as surplusage much of the rest of the statute if this were a freestanding power, as they hypothesize. The third prism to look through at this provision at is through case law. And again, McAllister, as I said previously, indicates that the only power conservators have is to take action necessary to restore to solvency. If we look at historical practice, there have been hundreds, if not thousands, of conservators. And they cannot point to a single example of a conservator doing anything remotely like this, taking all of the profits in perpetuity for the Treasury, and perhaps even more noxiously and inconsistent with the statute, putting a cap on the amount of capital. The statute says you have the authority to operate it soundly. Soundly has a meaning under the statute. Under 4513 shows that soundness means capital. And this net worth sweep puts an absolute cap on the amount of capital. By the end of this quarter, these institutions will have $0 in capital, notwithstanding the fact that they are insuring $5.8 trillion of assets. That is the height of unsoundness. So their statutory argument rests on those two pillars, and neither one of them bears any scrutiny. I'd like to talk about Treasury for a moment. Treasury claims that it too has immunity from judicial review. In fact, even more, Treasury claims even more immunity from judicial review than FHFA, because Treasury has a sunset provision. It says that as of December 31st, 2009, everybody agrees Treasury is not allowed to buy more shares. So if Treasury showed up tomorrow and said to the FHFA, we'd like to buy some more shares, that would violate HERA. We are told by the FHFA and Treasury that, in fact, that this court could do nothing to stop that. That Treasury, even though it would be flagrantly violating HERA, would have immunity. And we say, well, where do you get that? Where does HERA say that Treasury has immunity? And they say, well, 4617F, this would restrain or affect our power. That argument just proves too much. It's and if we look at cases like the Coit case from the United States Supreme Court, there, the government was enjoined, the FSLIC was enjoined, from making determinations about the validity of claims, notwithstanding the fact that it certainly had an impact on the operation of the receivership. So Treasury is claiming a broader judicial immunity than even FHFA, even though the statute doesn't in any way give it meaning, reference that immunity. That doesn't make any sense at all. I'd also like to just briefly go back and touch upon a couple of the other issues that have come up on our standing for the constitutional issue. One of the things they talk about is that it was an acting director. It wasn't that DeMarco was in an acting capacity at the time he did that. And there are a few answers to that. One of them is that they still have a problem that it doesn't matter because under 4512F, as I referenced, the president's selection of a successor would be limited to those deputies picked by the acting director. So that's a significant handcuff. In addition, they're wrong. The acting director has for cause removal protection. And that's true for a couple of reasons. Number one, we can look at the words of the statute. 4511A says that it is an independent agency. And it doesn't say it's an independent agency so long as there's a Senate-confirmed director. It says it's an independent agency. So we can look at the words of the statute. But the second thing we can look at is the Wiener test. This is the 1958 Supreme Court decision that said the touchstone, the best indication about trying to draw inferences about removal powers is the nature of the power that the official has. And the acting director has the exact same powers as the director. They have the same nature of the office. And so under the Wiener case and the standard it sets forth, then it's a fair inference that there is for-cause removal protection for the acting director. Finally, I would note that the Obama administration itself did not believe it had the ability to remove acting director DeMarco and was quite clear about that, and we pointed that out. I see I'm getting near to my rebuttal time. I'm happy to answer any questions or save my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good morning, Rob Caterberg for FHFA. If it pleases the court, I'll be addressing the 4617F anti-injunction provision as it relates to FHFA. Counsel for Treasury, Mr. Sinzdak, will be addressing the 4617F issue as it relates to Treasury, and I'll be addressing the constitutional issue pertaining to the structure of FHFA. Your Honors, the transaction here was well within the conservator's powers and functions. FHFA's structure is plainly constitutional, and even if the Constitution somehow required the President to have the power to remove an FHFA director at will, it would not, in any event, provide a basis for invalidating the securities transaction that the conservator...
Okay, why not? If we were to strike the part that requires cause and just say the President has the right to just fire the person, then why would that not require a full, you know, vacating of everything that's been done?
And the answer to that, Judge Haynes, is that has never been done in a removal restrictions case. So we can go through the line of cases that they rely on. Let's take their flagship case, Free Enterprise Fund. And you can see in the record, because we put it in the record, you can see what the final judgment, and this goes to your question, Judge Willett, that what the final judgment looks like in a case like this. This is pages 622 to 24 of the record. This is the district court's judgment on remand pursuant to the Supreme Court's instructions, and it is that the words in accordance with Section 107D3 for good cause shown are null and void and have been severed from the statute. Mind you, that is not what the plaintiffs wanted in Free Enterprise Fund. The plaintiffs went into court saying they wanted the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board to be shut down in its tracks, and all action that it has taken or is taking to be rendered null and void. And the Supreme Court, in the opinion by Chief Justice Roberts, says that's not what we're going to do. The remedy in a case like this, if the President's power has been unduly limited, is to strike the offending language so that it doesn't limit the power.
What about as in Noel Canning, where that an ORB had to go back and re-ratify a number of previous decisions it took when it was sort of unconstitutionally structured?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The reason that's different is that's not a removal restrictions case. That's a recess appointments clause case, and it's about a quorum of the NLRB. So a basic principle of governance by a collegial body is that you don't have a quorum, you can't act. And so that's what was going on there. There's a case from this circuit that they cite the Dresser versus Rand case where they note that was done, decisions that were made by the NLRB in that period.
So it's your view that striking the removal restriction would have zero impact on past actions of the FHFA?
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. And we can actually take it a step further in a case like this. Your Honors don't need to categorically rule that it would never be a basis for vacature of past agency action, because there's additional reasons why it doesn't make sense here. That is that the type of action that was taken here was not the kind of action that's an exercise of executive power that Article II demands be under the President's control. So it might be a different case if there was an exercise of law enforcement power, imposing a fine, imposing a civil penalty. That case could be saved for another day, but here, what happens, and this court and other courts have noted this, the Supreme Court noted it in the O'Melveny and Myers versus FDIC case, the conservator steps into the shoes of the financial institution that it's serving as conservator for. And so the type of transaction here, which is a business transaction, a financing agreement, that is not remotely within the realm of the types of functions and powers.
Fannie and Freddie have been in conservatorship now for over a decade. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, nearly a decade.
Will they ever leave? Yeah. Or is this just sort of like the government version of Hotel California? What does FHFA have plenary power, in your view, to do as it wishes, to do as it pleases? Is there any outer limit to the FHFA statutory power?
There are many outer limits. FHFA has to act within the bounds of the statute. FHFA is an agency that's constituted.
And who can take action to ensure that it does act within the bounds of its statute? Who's empowered to supervise?
Congress certainly has the power to amend the statute. If Congress were to determine that there was an appropriate way forward for how we're going to do housing finance in this country, then Congress can reform the statute and provide that path. The President has authority to oversee FHFA to a certain degree, pursuant to the removal power. It's for cause. FHFA is an independent agency, but that doesn't mean that FHFA is wholly separate.
What tools do courts have to ensure the FHFA acts lawfully?
Many, many tools, and Judge Willett, I'm glad you brought that up, because my opponent portrayed it as if FHFA is wholly outside of judicial review. That couldn't be further from the truth. I believe he's referring to 4617F, which is the anti-injunction provision, but your honors will note that that provision only bars injunctive and declaratory relief, equitable relief against FHFA. It doesn't touch actions for damages, and in fact, in other courts right now, there are pending actions for claims for damages by shareholders arising out of this securities transaction, the Third Amendment. There's a claim in the Court of Federal Claims for an alleged taking. Now, obviously, we dispute for a number of reasons that those claims have merit, but the notion that this is wholly outside of any form of judicial review was the
net worth sweep necessary to conserve and preserve Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac assets?
So we think necessity is not the test, and you'll see that in the Perry Capital majority opinion from the D.C. Circuit. We think the correct test for whether it's within the statutory powers is whether the type of function and power that Congress intended for conservators to engage in when it gave FHFA that expansive list of powers in 4617
be powers as conservator.
That's correct, Your Honor. The power as a conservator is to ensure that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac can continue to perform the important function that they perform of providing liquidity in the secondary mortgage market. It's not the power to conserve or to build up assets for the benefit of private shareholders. Congress couldn't have been clearer about that. In fact, Congress transferred the shareholder rights to FHFA upon conservatorship. That's in 4617.
That's the confusion I have, is how the siphoning, the quarterly siphoning of these companies' net worth, how that achieves the statute's goal of putting them in a sound and solvent condition.
Well, FHFA, Congress intended to give FHFA wide berth to carry out its responsibilities as conservator. The proof is in the pudding. These institutions are still very much in operation. We would know it, or we would know it the next time we went to get a mortgage, if they were no longer doing the job that Congress intended them to do. They have a backstop of nearly $250 billion from Treasury that enables them to keep doing that, and that is part and parcel with the securities transaction at issue here.
What executive oversight is there of the FHFA beyond the president's power to remove a director for cause? Beyond that for cause removal provision, what else can an executive do?
Well, there's the Federal Housing Oversight Board, and this is provided for by 4513A of the statute, and that's a four-person board that consists of the director as well as the Secretary of Treasury, the Secretary of HUD, both cabinet members, and the director of the CFPB, and they meet quarterly and advise the director on the best way to carry out the FHFA's responsibility. And look, FHFA is an independent agency. We see no reason to quarrel with that. That's what Congress intended. And so FHFA in that regard stands no different than any independent agency. But that is not the test that courts have applied in determining whether agency structures comport with Article II. So, Your Honors, I do want to turn back to the standing issues because I think they're very serious here. And in addition to the fact that vacature of past agency actions is not the remedy, it's never been the remedy in an Article II removal restrictions case, another distinctive feature of the claim here and the transaction challenged here is that it's a two-way transaction. It takes two to contract. And here, the challenged transaction is a contract with the Treasury Department, which everyone agrees is wholly within the plenary power of the president. So the removal power is just a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. And it's a means to the end of the president having some modicum of control over what goes on in the government. And if the president did not like the Third Amendment, it was very simple. All he had to do was pick up the phone and call the Secretary of the Treasury and say, don't do this. So the additional independence of FHFA mattered not one bit to the president's ability to do that. In fact, the complaint here actually takes it a step further, and you can look at paragraphs 106 and 107 of the complaint to see a very detailed narrative that they portray. And again, we're not buying into any of this, but this is their narrative. They say that Treasury pushed That's their word. Treasury pushed FHFA to implement the Third Amendment, and senior White House officials actively worked to bring it about and considered it the administration's plan. So it'd be very ironic for a alleged infringement of the president's removal power to serve as the basis for vacating this particular transaction. But if I may turn to the merits of the constitutional claim, Humphrey's executor established many decades ago that it does not violate Article II when Congress creates independent agencies and makes their heads removable only for cause. And really, the only issue here, we think, boils down to whether Humphrey's executor applies when an agency is headed by a single director, as FHFA is. I heard Mr. Thompson talk about the threat to liberty from a single director agency. That's never been the test in an Article II case. Up until the panel opinion in PHH at the D.C. Circuit that's now been vacated, that had never been the guiding consideration to determine whether there was a violation of Article II. Article II has always been about whether the president has the power to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. Mr. Thompson also referred to staggered terms. So when you have a multi-member body, you can have staggered terms. But in that case, the degree to which that helps or does not help the president is going to turn entirely on how those terms are staggered. And if, for example, I commend to your Honor's attention the analysis of the district judge in Pennsylvania in the CFPB versus Navient case. It's cited in our brief. That judge actually mapped out how staggered terms for the FTC compare to four-year presidential terms, and found that the 80% of presidential terms will get the opportunity to appoint a director of the CFPB, and the same would go for FHFA, because FHFA is also a five-year term, and whereas only 4/7, and that's about 57% of four-year presidential administrations, will have an opportunity to appoint a majority of the FTC. There's bipartisanship. It's very ironic, I think, for bipartisanship to be seen as something that would promote presidential control, because what that means is when the president may get to appoint one or two out of a body of five, but they're going to have dissenters there from the previous administration. So I doubt very much that many presidents would consider that as making it more conducive to their control rather than less.
Let me take you briefly back to the statute. So the FIREA conservatorship language, materially identical, as if it were kind of lifted, you know, cut and pasted verbatim from FIREA to HERA. And I just wonder, under your interpretation of the broad kind of powers of FHFA as conservator here, and again, given the identical conservator language in those two statutes, I'm just teasing out this hypothetical. With the FDIC acting as conservator of a troubled bank, would it be able to seize depositor funds in that bank and give it to somebody else?
I think that would be a totally different situation, Your Honor, and the reason why is that the best interests language, and I'm talking here about 4617B2J, so FHFA as conservator has the power to take such interests that as are in the best interests of the enterprises or the agency. The FDIC statute has a materially different provision there that also requires the FDIC to take into account the best interests of the depositors. So without hazarding a view, because I think it would probably depend on a lot of different factors, but I think that that language in the FDIC statute, for which there is no equivalent in the FHFA statute, HERA, I think that would probably serve to prevent the hypothetical Your Honor is talking about from happening. Mr. Thompson briefly referred to the non-delegation issue as a reason to read the statute as he says it should be read. The non-delegation doctrine requires intelligible principles for a delegation of legislative power, but again, the action here is not even legislative in nature in the first place. It's running a business. It's conducting a business transaction to ensure the continued operation of Fannie and Freddie. Your Honors, I see that my time is almost up. I'll defer the rest of my time to counsel for Treasury. Bless Your Honors, any questions?
All right. Thank you, sir.
May it please the court, Jerry Sinsdag, appearing on behalf of the Treasury Department. Two provisions independently bar plaintiff's claims in this case. One's already been discussed at some length, 4617F, the
anti-injunction. Try to speak in there, yep. Just a little bit more robust.
I apologize. I'll
no worries.
Speak up. That provision, as every court to consider the question has held, bars plaintiffs' APA claims in this case. The Third Amendment was an exercise of FHFA's powers as conservator to operate the entities, to conduct the business of the entities, to contract on behalf of the entities, etc. It is therefore, this court and all courts are barred from second-guessing the judgment, the necessity of that, and the reasonableness of that agreement.
Perry Capital last year, split decision, divided court, but I thought they were unanimous on the proposition that 4617F doesn't bar judicial scrutiny where FHFA indeed does exceed its statutory powers. Would you dispute that?
No, Your Honor. That is the law of the circuit as well under the Ward case. This is but as that court held, and as the Sixth Circuit held, right, this fits well within that, and in addition also applies to Treasury as a counterparty to the transaction. Now, there's another provision that also independently bars the claim, and that is the transfer of shareholder rights or succession provision, is the way that D.C. Circuit described it. That provision transfers all rights of shareholders to FHFA upon its appointment as conservator. And one such right, which I don't think this is disputed, this is well-settled law, is the right to bring a derivative suit on behalf of the corporation. And here, plaintiffs' claims, both their APA claims and their constitutional claims, are classic derivative claims. They claim an injury that is to the corporation, and they seek a remedy. And this goes back to opposing counsel in response to Judge Willett's question about what the remedy would be. And one remedy they seek is potentially the return of funds from Treasury to the GSEs. Well, that's a remedy that would flow to the GSEs directly. It would not flow to the shareholders directly, as would the accounting adjustment for the GSEs. So the plaintiffs would benefit as shareholders indirectly, but that is a quintessential derivative claim, when the harm and the remedy flow to the corporation and only indirectly to shareholders. So for that reason, plaintiffs' claims are independently barred by that provision. And one point I would just like to be clear about, I know there have been some questions about soundness and solvency, just to make sure, I'm sure Your Honors are aware, how the Treasury commitment works. And the Treasury, since 2008, has provided or committed $450 billion, an unprecedented amount of money, to the GSEs that they can draw from whenever their net worth falls below zero to ensure that it will never happen. Now, the entities so far, through 2012, have drawn approximately $190 billion. But there remains, to this day, a $260 billion commitment from Treasury of taxpayer funds that remains available to the GSEs that they can use anytime their net worth falls below zero. And that commitment is what is keeping the enterprises in operation. It's what's giving the market confidence in the continued operation of these enterprises. And of course, these aren't run-of-the-mill banks either. These are enterprises that provide a vital service to the housing market and the mortgage markets. And it's that commitment that is crucial. So when FHFA was renegotiating the dividend obligations, it was doing so with its most important investor, and actually its critical investor, the only entity that was willing to put up the funds needed. Now, of course, plaintiffs dispute whether it was necessary to enact the Third Amendment, or whether it was a wise decision, or whether it was an act of a good or conservator. But those are all questions going to the wisdom of the decision in the business judgment of FHFA, and this court has been clear on the FERIA, in the Sixth Circuit and the D.C. Circuit.
In terms of structure, is the FHFA materially or meaningfully different from the CFPB?
Your Honor, the government is not taking a position on the differences between the two with respect to
the
separation.
The government did take a position in the CFPB case.
Yes, the government took the position that the permanent director of the CFPB, as Your Honor knows, violated separation of powers, but that was the decision the Solicitor General made with respect to a certain agency in a certain context. It did not take a position, has not taken a position.
Okay, so today you're not taking a position.
We're not taking a position.
Any differences between the constitutional structure of those two entities?
We are not, Your Honor. Now, we do believe that there's no need, for the reasons we set forth in the brief, to reach the question of the constitutionality of the permanent director of the FHFA. Happy to discuss those, but one, of course, is again the fact that this is a derivative claim, as evidenced by the remedy that plaintiffs seek. And constitutional claims are barred if they're derivative in the same way. Shareholders are not permitted to bring constitutional claims belonging to the entity. Your Honors, happy to discuss any issues that are remaining, or if Your Honors have any further questions, I'm happy to discuss them.
It's your time, so.
Thank you.
All right, we're back to you, Mr. Thompson.
Okay, great. Thank you, Your Honors. I have about 17 points I'd like to make quickly in the next 5 minutes, so I'll do my best.
We saw you writing furtively.
Yes, Your Honor. There was a question about, is the CFPB essentially similarly situated for constitutional purposes as the FHFA? And the FHFA is worse for at least two reasons. Number one, it has 4617F. It can violate, under their interpretation, and I think every court's interpretation, every federal statute other than HERA. It can violate, and no court can do anything about it. Second of all, the Financial Stability Oversight Board has a veto over the CFPB. My friend, Mr. Kederberg, referenced an oversight board for FHFA. It is advisory. There is a world of difference between a veto and advice. There was some discussion about the remedy in free enterprise. In free enterprise, there was no final agency action. There was nothing to vacate. That's why there wasn't vacatur there. There was also a discussion, well, Noel Canning, that was an appointments clause case, and this is a removal power case. But there's never been any discussion of why that should make a difference. And there's no case that suggests it should make a difference. There was reference was made to the need to conserve assets. And one thing, just to put in historical perspective, conservators normally, it says may conserve and preserve the assets. And there's a priority scheme. We see that for the receiver. There isn't a priority scheme of distributions for the conservator because they're not supposed to do distributions. And here, the dividends were massive. In a record of appeal, ROA 77, in our complaint, we set out that when there were paper profits at the companies that totaled $59 billion, under the sweep, they had to go into the debt markets and borrow debt to pay dividends on a paper profit. That is the antithesis of soundness. There was reference was made to the backstop that is still out there. A couple of points. Number one, the government's already made $90 billion in profits off of this arrangement. Second of all, Director Watt has been very clear that that backstop is not capital. And the PSPAs themselves are explicit in defining the backstop not to be capital. And if anything, the net worth sweep makes that commitment maximally vulnerable to draw, because in the absence of the sweep, there would be $124 billion of capital on the balance sheet that could be drawn upon if there are losses, and now there is zero. There was discussion about Humphrey's executor, and obviously that was a multi-member panel, a body of experts, but there was also the appropriation power. The president had the power over the FTC through appropriations. That is lacking here, and of course there was no immunity from judicial review. We were told that liberty is irrelevant, that it's not a factor in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence. Over and over again, the Supreme Court, particularly in Boucher, has said the reason we have separation of powers is to protect our liberty. So liberty, Judge Kavanaugh was absolutely right to emphasize liberty. That's why we have the separation of powers. We're told that, well, on average, some presidents may be better off. That just won't cut it for separation of powers. One branch can't dip into the power of another branch and say, well, but at other instances, you'll be better off. That's not, there's no case that suggests that's the appropriate way to proceed. As to whether this is a derivative claim, APA claims are direct. And moreover, even if we were looking at state law and we shouldn't, the injury was to the shareholders. We were taken out of the capital structure, and under our preferred remedy of the accounting adjustment, we would be restored to the capital structure. And I see I have 36 minutes, seconds left, and I'm happy to yield that back if there are no questions.
Thank you, sir. Thanks to all counsel for the robust briefing in the case and the vigorous argument as well. This concludes the orally argued cases that we have today. It also concludes the Northern District of Texas sitting for this panel. And I will just reiterate my appreciation to all here in Fort Worth and in Dallas, and to my two colleagues for making a very enjoyable sitting. And I do want to thank our erstwhile courtroom deputy, Ms. Shirley Englehart, who has come here a couple days early and who always makes these trips, and to all our technical people that have made things good for us. Thanks again to our visitors. We hope that you enjoyed the arguments this morning. Having said that, the panel will stand adjourned.